Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
After a campus shooting, Florida State University is trying to get back to normal as quickly as possible. But even as classes and the library reopen, students remain rattled.
It's scary stuff, you know, when things like this happen. It kind of shows, our vulnerabilities.
As Democrats continue to spar among themselves in public, some wonder how that looks for the party as a whole.
How the optics of that looks good for Florida is beyond me. As a Democrat, what is going to inspire anyone to run for office with that kind of scenario playing out?
Also this week, a recent court ruling throws off the timeline for a non-euphoric strain of medical marijuana, and a 1980s murder continues to divide two families. I'm Lynn Hatter in for Tom Flanagan, and you're listening to Capitol Report. Florida State University students are back in class after a shooting at the campus library injured three people. The tragedy has raised the same questions asked after any school shooting. How could this happen? But Regan McCarthy reports at Florida State it's also raised a stronger feeling of community and support.
Just after midnight Thursday morning, a gunman entered Strozier Library on Florida State University's campus. He'd studied there as an undergrad before going on to earn a law degree from Texas Tech in 2009. But none of that explains why he opened fire, injuring two students and a university employee.
We have not found any information at this time to indicate why he chose this morning to act or why he chose the Strozier Library as the place for his actions.
That's Tallahassee Police Chief Michael DeLeo speaking during a press conference the afternoon the event took place. DeLeo says the gunman, Myron May, was in what he calls a state of crisis.
It's clear that, Mr. May's, sense of being and place in our community was not what most people would refer to as a normal status, that he was in a sense of crisis and he was searching for something.
DeLeo says May left behind a journal and videos indicating he felt someone was targeting him. According to a report from the Associated Press, a package mailed by the gunman has arrived in Texas. Officials expect it will contain more videos or journals that could lead to glimpses of answers. But FSU's new president, John Thrasher, says answers or not, the school is moving forward.
We're moving ahead. We're continuing to pray for the victims, and pray for Florida State University, but we're going to get through this with the great family we have.
We pray for the victims that are recovering right now, that you heal them. We pray for the families that...
On the afternoon of the shooting, students are gathered near the student union, not far from the library. They're praying and hugging. Stefano Cavallaro is the student body president.
I think the student body is definitely mourning right now and very conscious about, just such an egregious act of violence on our campus. But I think that, we'll come out stronger from this.
And by the time of a vigil hosted that evening, students' spirits and voices were already getting stronger. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Tallahassee Police Department officials have released the names of the three victims injured by a gunman Thursday on Florida State University's campus. They include 18-year-old Elijah Velez, who police say was grazed by a bullet and treated at the scene, as well as 30-year-old Nathan Scott and 21-year-old Farhan Ahmed, who are still being treated at the hospital. The losses Democrats took during the 2014 midterm election are causing rifts within the party ranks. Still, the general consensus is for the party to unite and move forward. But as Sasha Cordner reports, some political scientists say that can only happen once what's called the blame game phase is over.
Losing Florida's gubernatorial race was a big blow to Democrats in this election. They also lost a number of races across the state and the nation. Among the losses were several seats in the Florida House, which created a GOP supermajority, and those defeats led Daytona Beach Democrat Dwayne Taylor to publicly challenge West Palm Beach Democrat Mark Pafford for the role of minority leader.
A seventh vote in 1 year and 8 months. How the optics of that looks good for Florida is beyond me. As a Democrat, what is going to inspire anyone to run for office with that kind of scenario playing out?
That's an angry Florida Democratic Party Chair Allison Tant telling the News Service of Florida her thoughts on the matter. She says in her close to 2 years on the job, she's seen seven leadership votes within the caucus, and she adds the party has no time for the drama.
We have to marshal our energies, put on our big girl pants, and move the heck down the road. The bedwetters need to shut up and we need to move on. It is time to get back to what matters, and that is protecting and standing up for the middle class Floridian and quit this belly aching and be a leader and grow up.
Her latter remarks caught the attention of many within the party and outside, like outspoken Fort Walton Beach Republican Matt Gaetz, who commented several times about the infighting on Twitter, even at one point comparing the Democrats to cannibals.
Never have I seen so few fight so hard for so little.
And weeks later, and the day of the leadership race, Taylor pulled out of the race, partly blaming Tant.
I still believe that I had the numbers or the following, but it wasn't really about that. It was more about, you know, me being able to work with the leadership there at the Florida Democratic Party. I think they may have undermined any and everything that I would try to do to help recruit members and to get members here. So I think they need some leadership there.
Taylor says he's already spoken with Pafford and will assist him in any way he can. And in his recent remarks to the caucus as its new leader, Pafford spoke about the importance of unity.
When we're here, when we have 38 folks in the back row, it's important that we maintain that unity over the next 2 years.
And as for Tant, she says,
really glad it's behind us.
So now, with the party trying to move forward, Tant has created a 14-member task force, which includes Miami-Dade Democratic Chair and Miami Senator Dwight Bullard.
You know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And unfortunately, we've been sort of putting out an energy as Democrats that has not been successful in terms of statewide elected office. So I'm hoping to bring, you know, some recommendations that hopefully will be listened to, successful tactics that have worked in a number of local races that I've been a part of, and hopefully that translates on a statewide level.
But other Democrats are doubtful the task force can deliver, and Nan Rich is one of them. The former gubernatorial candidate says that's because she believes there are some people on the panel that shouldn't be on there.
I think it's important not to put people on committees and task forces that were part of the ones that created the strategies that I think were part of the reason we lost. To me, it's like the fox watching the hen house. You have to be careful who you put on these committees to make sure that you can have a legitimate, honest, objective analysis of what happened.
Same thing happened after Republicans lost the 2012 presidential. They blamed each other. They blamed the pollsters. They blamed their strategists. They blamed the get-out-the-vote people.
That's University of South Florida political scientist Susan McManus, who says this sort of infighting and trying to get back on track to a united front is very typical after an election, no matter the party.
When it falls short, people just point fingers, and it happens, as we're seeing here, to Democrats who lose a big race. It's just the name of the game. The blame game, then the fix-it game. That's always the cycle that it goes through.
Meanwhile, like the state's Dems, Florida Congresswoman and National Democratic Committee Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz is also putting together a similar panel to find out what went wrong on a national level. She recently enlisted the public's help for their input as well. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
The
Florida House Speaker and Senate President set the tone and often choose priorities for each lawmaking session. And as new legislative leaders took their oaths of office this week, Jessica Palumbo reports they talked about what Floridians can expect during their terms.
Florida's new House Speaker is Merritt Island Republican Steve Crisafulli. When he took to the chamber lectern for the first time, he made it clear he's a small government kind of guy.
The debate over the role of government has fiercely been contested for time immemorial. In my judgment, it is often the case that complex problems facing our society are often compounded by government interference. There's a legitimate role for government to play in our lives. However, make no mistake, that role must be limited.
Crisafulli is a seventh-generation Floridian whose family has owned cattle and citrus farms.
A few years ago, there was a proposal in the House to deregulate the registration, and I'm looking at Speaker Cannon, to deregulate the registration of livestock brands through the Department of Agriculture, an effort I opposed for a simple reason. It violated one of the legitimate roles of government to protect our private property rights.
Before being handed the gavel, made from wood harvested at his family's orange grove, Crisafulli was officially nominated by Land O'Lakes Republican Representative Richard Corcoran. Corcoran says the new speaker has a rare quality among elected officials.
Fortunately for all of us, it is a trait that our next speaker exemplifies. Member Steve Crisafulli always, always keeps his word.
Speaking to reporters after the swearing-in ceremony, Crisafulli said his number one legislative priority is water management. Meanwhile, in the other legislative chamber, his counterpart, Senate President Andy Gardner, addressed a new constitutional amendment setting aside money for water and land conservation. Gardner says the initiative, known as Amendment 1, will undoubtedly cause some pain as lawmakers craft a budget this year.
The challenge Amendment 1 is not spending more money on environment. We already spend millions of dollars in dock stamp and other state revenues on environmental issues. The challenge facing the Senate is the impact on Amendment 1 on other areas that are also funded by dock stamp revenues, specifically transportation, affordable housing, and economic development.
The Orlando Republican said the Senate must do its best to continue the last few years' economic growth. He ended with a promise to be the best possible servant leader.
I am truly beyond words, humble, and I will do everything I can to make you and my family and my mom and dad proud. Thank you. Thank you.
Gardner, Crisafulli, and the rest of the legislature returned to Tallahassee in January for committee meetings ahead of the full legislative session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Still to come on Capitol Report, state lawmakers were aiming to have low-THC marijuana distributors chosen by January 1st, but a recent court ruling has thrown that timeline off.
Yeah, I think that the judge's ruling eviscerates the January 1 deadline to get cannabis licenses out.
And Florida's newly passed Amendment 1 could wind up very different from what most voters thought was a simple land-buying measure.
So what we're getting into then, I've described as a parks versus pipes debate.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Lynn Hatter. The high-profile case of a deaf inmate was the subject of lengthy debate Wednesday before the Florida Commission on Offender Review. The panel heard perplexing and at times emotionally charged testimony before deciding whether to move up parole dates for two brothers accused of a 1980s murder. It's cramped in the small room, and more than 50 people have squeezed in hip to hip and shoulder to shoulder to hear the rulings of the three people who are deciding the future of 51 Florida inmates. Among the crowd are Virginia Campoa Moore, Marie Clark, Jonadine Gonzalez, and Emily Hobson, sisters of Joseph Tremontano. He was murdered more than 30 years ago. The sisters say Felix Garcia, one of the men convicted of the crime, should never be released.
This is the only time I ever saw my father cry, ever, was
because my brother was murdered.
Basically, from that moment on, my mother never really could talk to you.
They murdered him for jewelry and money.
But Felix Garcia and his supporters say he admitted guilt for something he did not do. They claim because he's deaf, he didn't understand what was happening at his trial and that he was framed by his brother, Francisco Garcia, who was also convicted for his role in the murder. But in a twist, at Wednesday's hearing, Mark Garcia, their brother, tells another story.
I know my brother, Frank. I know my brother, Felix. I've lived with the tempers on both of them. I know the situations that they get themselves into. I know how they get themselves out of. I can tell you right now, by my heart, I know 100%. I know Frank did not do that.
Mark, who was 15 at the time of the crime, believes Francisco, not Felix, is the innocent one in what he describes as a drug deal gone bad. Mike and his sister Tina spoke in support of Francisco. And Pat Bliss, a paralegal who has advocated for Felix during the past 18 years, says she's shocked.
She had her opportunity this year to make things right because she was the driver. It was she, Frank, and Ray Stanley, who were the three that were involved with this crime. They did the planning, and they were involved with this crime.
Meanwhile, Reginald Garcia, Felix's attorney, says Tina has also claimed Felix is innocent. While the panel, formerly known as the Parole Commission, does not relitigate crimes, it found itself having to consider the situation of both Felix and Francisco Garcia, as well as their family, the victim's family, and whether after decades of incarceration, anything has changed. In the case of Francisco Garcia, Commissioner Melinda Coonrod feels it is not.
Francisco, he either has wrongfully implicated his brother or he is lying by filing an affidavit stating that he was not. So the character of Francisco Garcia is in question with me.
The panel opted against changing Francisco's possible parole date, but Felix Garcia could have less time to wait. The panel set a new potential release date of 2025, a decrease of a year for his achievements inside of prison, including earning work certifications, good behavior, and getting a GED. Next year, patients across Florida suffering from extreme seizures and a handful of other symptoms should be able to get their hands on low-THC marijuana. But exactly when next year is unclear. An administrative law court scrapped much of the proposed distribution framework last week, and as Nick Evans reports, that leaves stakeholders with hope for a better system and certainly a longer wait.
Low-THC marijuana, and in particular an oil called Charlotte's Web, has shown promise in helping epilepsy patients whose seizures don't respond to traditional drugs.
30% of patients with epilepsy are considered intractable, and so RAM falls in that category, meaning there's nothing, you know, that works.
That's Holly Mosley. She and her daughter Rayanne were the driving force behind the bill allowing low-THC marijuana in Florida. Mosley lobbied her local representative, Fort Walton Beach Republican Matt Gates, to sponsor legislation bringing the treatment to Florida. That process certainly wasn't easy, especially in an election year marked by little legislative action, but it was successful. The bill passed with broad bipartisan support. But developing a system for cultivating, processing, and distributing the marijuana hasn't gone quite so well. The legislature charged the Department of Health with constructing the framework, and from the outset, its proposals have been met with stiff resistance. Last week, a judge threw out many of the department's proposed rules. Speaking at a House organizational session, Gates acknowledged this is a setback.
Yeah, I think that the judge's ruling eviscerates the January 1 deadline to get cannabis licenses out. That's disappointing, but I'd rather measure twice and cut once.
And Florida Medical Cannabis Association lobbyist Ron Watson says the ruling leaves a lot of uncertainty.
So where we find ourselves now is what happens next. Does the department appeal? Does the department try to change the rules under the direction that the judge has given? And or will the legislature get involved again now that that Amendment 2 didn't pass, but it got close to 58%?
Amendment 2, which would have instituted a much broader medical marijuana policy, came very close to passing in the last election. And many, including some lawmakers, have spoken about the possibility of the legislature taking action to expand beyond low-THC marijuana. But Gates isn't rushing to make any changes.
I think that there is some hope that we can allow the reforms that we passed last year to sink in so that we have an opportunity to analyze the elements that will work and maybe some that would need to be tweaked.
And Holly Mosley is on the same page.
You know, let's put all of our focus into what we have on the table now and make this the best possible system in place.
But even if the legislature stays on the sidelines, it's difficult to tell how close the department is to a workable policy. Ron Watson explains even if revisions were ready right this instant, there are a lot of potential hurdles before patients get treatment.
Time, and then the processes of the 21-day notice and then having to go to CHAPC and then potentially somebody else challenging it. Again, January 1 is going to be difficult.
Mosley understands the path ahead is long and arduous, but she says the most important thing is getting this right.
Of course, we want it as parents. We want it now because we live with our children daily who are suffering. You know, I had to pick Rayan up from school yesterday for seizures. So, I want it now. However, at the same time, I have to remind myself that I want it to be done correctly.
The department says it will consider all options that will most expeditiously get this product to market to help families facing serious illnesses. But department officials won't comment on when they'll decide between rewriting the rules or appealing the ruling. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Florida's unemployment rate fell to 6% for October, but Donald Debevoise reports some question if the downward trend will continue.
At 6%, unemployment is the lowest it's been since June of 2008. Bureau of Economic and Business Research Director Chris McCarty says he thinks the drop is largely due to a healthier housing industry and more construction opportunities. McCarty wonders, though, just how long housing growth will last.
In the current environment, I think we're doing fine. The question remains what the Federal Reserve is going to do in terms of short-term interest rates and how those are going to translate into mortgage rates and how that might affect the growth that we've had in the housing industry.
McCarty says he expects the unemployment rate to stay low during the upcoming holiday season when there will be a spike in retail positions. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Donald Debevoise.
And finally, on Capitol Report, by an overwhelming margin, Florida voters okayed Amendment 1 earlier this month. Tom Flanagan spoke with an environmental reporter who's been digging into how the amendment might actually be implemented by the Florida legislature.
On Capitol Report, we're talking with Bruce Ritchie, independent journalist covering environment and growth management issues in Florida. He also edits FloridaEnvironments.com, and we welcome him to Capitol Report today. Bruce, you just came out with an article talking about Amendment 1 and the fact that perhaps, as it will ultimately turn out, may be a little bit different than the way that voters perceived it when they approved it overwhelmingly in the election. What was that all about?
Well, certainly the shorthand for Amendment 1 was it was the Conservation Lands Amendment, and most of the discussion about the amendment, there was very little debate about the amendment. There was very little organized opposition to it, but most of the discussion was about conservation lands and how much money would be spent to buy parks and land for conservation, but mainly to replace the money that has not been spent in recent years for conservation lands under the Florida Forever program. Really, if you look closer at the amendment, it can be used for lands to maintain and protect water quality. And in talking with Senator David Simmons last week, he definitely felt like the revenue from that could go towards some of the
things he's been trying to do to get springs cleaned up, and what has included hooking up septic tanks to sewage treatment plants and sometimes upgrading sewage treatment plants. So what we're getting into then I've described as a parks versus pipes debate.
Many folks in the environmental community have kind of been in agreement with the fact that more needs to be done to remove point source pollution from springs recharge zones like Wakulla Springs and Ginny Springs and all of that across the state. So you would think that maybe they'd look at this and say, well, gee, that sounds like a good idea, but that isn't what you found.
I think that there are a lot of people out there who do think that it's a good idea to clean up springs and reduce sources of pollution. But in the case of this conservation lands amendment, I think for most people the hope was that the funding for the Florida Forever program would go back to the $300 million that it enjoyed before 2009, $300 million a year, and that perhaps there would even be additional funding for a variety of other conservation lands measures, that in the end it would result in more places for people to go and visit and recreate, as opposed to dealing with pollution issues.
When lawmakers return to Tallahassee in March and start hammering out the implementing language for Amendment 1, do you predict that there is going to be a big pipes versus parks battle going on there?
I don't know how much is going to be said or debated publicly, but I think it's going to be in the background. And frankly, it'll probably be in the background throughout the length of the 20 years provided for in the amendment. If you think about it, perhaps petroleum tank cleanups or hazardous waste sites could be one far end of the spectrum of what this money could be spent on, and there could be a whole lot of things in between there and getting into state parks. Even the supporters have talked about spending the money on conservation easements. That's where you pay private landowners not to develop their property. And certainly Governor Scott has suggested that he wants money next year to go towards that. And he has talked about already saying that the state is spending money towards environmental projects as provided for the amendment, such as sewage treatment plants and springs projects for wastewater. So it's out there. I just believe it's going to be something that that we're going to have to watch and cover, and it's going to be an issue that will be discussed. I don't know how vigorously it will be debated, perhaps if it goes too far in the direction toward cleanup projects.
Lots of devilish details still to come in putting Amendment 1 into place, even though it got an overwhelming approval from voters back in the election. And we appreciate your insights. Bruce Ritchie, independent journalist covering environment and growth management issues in Tallahassee. Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you, Tom.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Kordner, Nick Evans, Jessica Palumbo, and Regan McCarthy. Tom Flanagan is back next week. Tonight we say a special goodbye to reporter Jessica Palumbo. Jessica is heading to Jacksonville to become news director of WJCT. Jessica, we'll miss you. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.